Here's an I asked many children at different ages about the conditions, actions, and thoughts that would make it harder or easier for them to wait for their treats during the marshmallow test. None of these children had taken the test before, and they were introduced to it in the standard way. The child was seated at the little table, the selected treats were exposed on top of the tray, the bell was introduced, and the one treat now or two later contingency was explained. At this point, instead of leaving to let the child begin to wait, the researcher asked about the conditions that would help him or her wait. For example, would it be easier to wait if the marshmallows were on top of the tray so you could see them, or if they were under the tray so that you couldn't see them? At age 3, most children could not understand the question and did not know what to say. 4-year-olds understood what we were asking but systematically selected the worst strategy. They wanted to expose the rewards during the delay period and to think about them, stare at them, and focus on how good they would be to eat. When asked why they were exposing the rewards, they said, "Because it makes me feel good," or "I just want to see it," or "It's so yummy," apparently focusing on what they wanted, "I like them," not yet understanding or caring that seeing the rewards would make it most difficult for them to wait. They wanted what they were waiting for to be right there in front of their eyes, and by having the rewards exposed, they defeated their own solemn intentions to wait, surprising themselves when they saw that they had rung the bell and grabbed the treat. They not only failed to correctly predict their behavior, but they insisted on creating the conditions that would make it impossible for them to get the delayed rewards. These findings may help parents understand why their 4-year-olds can still have such a hard time controlling themselves. Within a year or so, the change in the children was striking. By age 5 to 6, most preferred to obscure the rewards and consistently rejected arousing thoughts about them as a strategy for self-control. Instead, they tried to distract themselves from the temptation. "Just sing a song," or "I guess I'll go to outer space," or "I think I'll take a bath." As they got older, they also began to see the value of focusing on the contingency and reiterating it. "If I wait, I can get the 2 marshmallows, but if I ring, I'll get just 1. And they advised themselves with instructions. "I'll say no, do not ring the bell. If I ring the bell and the teacher comes in, I'll just get that 1. "How should you wait for the marshmallows to make it easy?" I asked Simon, age 9. He gave me his answer in a drawing of someone sitting during the marshmallow test with a thought bubble showing that he was thinking about "something I like to distract myself." His additional written advice to me: "Don't look at what you're waiting for. Don't think about nothing, because then you're thinking about it. Use what you have at the moment to entertain yourself." In further conversation, Simon explained how he managed this. He told me, "I have at least 1,000 imaginary characters in my head, like those little toy figures I have in my room, and in my imagination, I just take them out and play with them. I make up stories and adventures." Like Simon, other children his age can be wonderfully creative as they use their imaginations to entertain themselves and make the time pass quickly when they need to delay gratification in situations like the marshmallow test. Most children did not seem to recognize the value of cool thoughts over arousing hot thoughts until around age 12. By then, they usually understood that hot thoughts about the treats would defeat delay, whereas cool thoughts that transform the marshmallows into puffy clouds, for example, would reduce their desirability and make it easier to wait. As one boy put it, "I can't eat puffy clouds." The key question that drove this work was, does knowledge of the strategies that make delay easier also give the child, and the adult for that matter, greater freedom from being controlled and pushed around by temptations and pressures they're trying to resist? We found the answer many years later in a study of boys with impulsivity problems who were living in a summer camp residential treatment program, described in Chapter 15. Those who understood strategies for delaying gratification waited longer on the marshmallow test than those who did not have this knowledge, and this was true even when the roles of age and verbal intelligence were controlled and removed statistically. It became clear that enhancing such understanding could become a goal for parents and teachers that might be fairly easy to achieve. Caveats. In the 1980s, I reported some of the early findings from the Stanford follow-up studies at a leading behavioral science research institute in Europe. I talked about the correlations we found between seconds of waiting on the marshmallow test and outcomes in adolescence, including SAT scores. A few months later, Myra, a friend who was a senior researcher at the institute and had heard my talk, contacted me. She told me in all seriousness that she had some news that worried her. At age 4, her son consistently refused to wait for more cookies, his favorites, no matter how hard she tried to get him to do so. An excellent scientist was misreading the meaning of the correlations I had reported. Myra was thinking, at least when it came to her son, that findings that were statistically significant and consistent for groups of children implied that if her child could not delay gratification on the measure she tried, it meant he faced a dire future. When Myra calmed down, she of course realized how incorrectly she had interpreted the results. Correlations that are meaningful, consistent, and significant statistically can allow broad generalizations for a population, but not necessarily confident predictions for an individual. Look at tobacco use, for example. Many people who smoke die early from tobacco-induced diseases, but some, indeed many, don't. If Johnny in preschool waits for his marshmallows, you know that he is able to delay gratification, at least in that situation. If he doesn't, you can't be sure what it means. It could mean that he wanted to wait but couldn't, or simply that he had not used the bathroom before sitting down for the test. If a young child is eager to delay but finds herself ringing the bell, it's worth trying to understand the reasons. As discussed in later chapters, some children start low in delay ability and get better at it over the years. And some start out eager and able to delay, and then show decreasing levels of self-control over time. The experiments at the Bing Nursery School demonstrated how mental representations of temptations can change and even reverse their impact on behavior. The child who can't wait a minute can manage to wait for 20 when he changes his thoughts about temptations. To me, that finding is more critical than the long-term correlations, because it points the way to strategies that can enhance self-control ability and reduce stress. And advances in cognitive neuroscience and brain imaging in the last few decades have opened a window into the brain mechanisms underlying the ability to delay gratification. We can now begin to see how our thoughts can cool the brain when we most need to control our impulses. 3. Thinking hot and cool. Once upon a time, by some estimates about 1.8 million years ago, our evolutionary ancestors were emerging from the trees of the river forest environment of the great apes. They were becoming Homo erectus, walking around on 2 feet in the grassy areas and struggling to live and reproduce. In these prehistoric adventures, the human species probably survived and multiplied thanks to the hot emotional system of the brain, the limbic system. The hot emotional system. The limbic system consists of primitive brain structures located under the cortex on top of the brain stem, which developed early in our evolution. These structures regulate basic drives and emotions essential for survival, from fear and anger to hunger and sex. This system helped our ancestors cope with the hyenas, lions, and other wild beasts that were both their food supply and their daily mortal danger. Within the limbic system, the amygdala, a small almond-shaped structure, amygdala means almond in Latin, is especially important. It plays a key role in fear responses and in sexual and appetitive behavior. The amygdala rapidly mobilizes the body for action. It does not pause to think and reflect or worry about long-term consequences. We still have a limbic system that works much as it did for our evolutionary ancestors. It remains our emotionally hot go system, specialized for quick reactions to strong emotion-arousing stimuli that automatically trigger pleasure, pain, and fear. At birth, it is already fully functional, making the infant cry when hungry or in pain. Although these days we rarely need it later in life for dealing with angry lions, it's still invaluable for avoiding menacing strangers in dark alleys or a swerving vehicle on an icy road. The hot system gives life its emotional zest. It motivates preschoolers to want two marshmallows, but it also makes it hard for them to endure the wait. Activation of the hot system triggers instantaneous action. Hunger for food and desire for other alluring stimuli elicit rapid, hot, go behaviors. Threats and danger signals elicit fear and automatic defensive and flight reactions. The hot system is somewhat similar to what Freud called the id. He saw this as the unconscious structure of the mind, which contains sexual and aggressive biological impulses to seek immediate gratification and tension reduction, impervious to the consequences. Like Freud's id, the hot system operates automatically and mostly unconsciously, but it is in the service of much more than the sexual and aggressive impulses of Freud's concern. Reflexive, simple, and emotional, it automatically and quickly triggers consumptive behavior, arousal, and impulsive action. It makes the preschooler ring the bell and eat the marshmallow, the dieter bite into the pizza, the cigarette addict inhale the smoke, the angry abuser strike the partner, and the sexually out-of-control male grab the cleaning lady. A focus on the hot features of a temptation easily triggers the go response. In the marshmallow experiments, I've watched a preschooler's hand suddenly lurch out and hit the bell hard as the surprised child looks down in distress to see what his hand has done. For four-year-olds, the trigger can be anticipating the chewy, sweet taste of the marshmallows. For dieters, alcoholics, and smokers, each of the hot features has its own distinctive pull that can make its victims helpless. Even the sight or thought of the candy bar or the whiskey or the cigarette can elicit action automatically. And the more often that happens, the more difficult it becomes to change the mental representation and avert the automatic go response. Learning and practicing some strategies for enabling self-control early in life is a lot easier than changing hot, self-destructive automatic response patterns established and ingrained over a lifetime. High stress activates the hot system. This response was adaptive in evolutionary history for dealing with oncoming lions because it produces amazingly rapid, in milliseconds, automatic self-protective reactions, and it is still useful in many emergencies in which survival requires instant action. But this hot response is not useful when success in a given situation depends on staying cool, planning ahead, and problem-solving rationally. And the hot system is predominant in the first few years of life, which makes it especially difficult for the young preschooler to exert self-control. The cool cognitive system. Closely interconnected with the brain's hot system is its cool system, which is cognitive, complex, reflective, and slower to activate. It is centered primarily in the prefrontal cortex, PFC. This cool, controlled system is crucial for future-oriented decisions and self-control efforts of the kind identified in the marshmallow test. It's important to note that high stress attenuates the cool system and accentuates the hot system. The hot and cool systems continuously and seamlessly interact in a reciprocal relationship. As one becomes more active, the other becomes less active. Although we rarely deal with lions, we daily face the endless stresses of the modern world in which the hot system is often up, leaving us with our cool system down just when we need it most. The PFC is the most evolved region of the brain. It enables and supports the highest order cognitive abilities that make us distinctively human. It regulates our thoughts, actions, and emotions, is the source of creativity and imagination, and is crucial for inhibiting inappropriate actions that interfere with the pursuit of goals. It allows us to redirect our attention and to change strategies flexibly as the requirements of the situation shift. Self-control ability is rooted in the PFC. The cool system develops slowly and becomes gradually more active in the preschool years and the first few years of elementary school. It does not fully mature until the early 20s, leaving the young child as well as the adolescent greatly vulnerable to the vicissitudes of the hot system. Unlike the hot system, the cool system is attuned to the informational aspects of stimuli and enables rational, reflective, and strategic behavior. As I described in earlier pages, Successful delayers in the marshmallow test invented ways to strategically distract themselves from the tempting treats and the bell. They also focused on the cool, abstract, informational features of the temptations as they imagined them. The marshmallows are like puffy clouds or cotton balls, and avoided or transformed their hot features to cool them down. Make believe it's just a picture. It's got a frame around it. You can't eat a picture. The diverse cognitive skills they used to wait for their treats are prototypes for those they needed years later to study for high school exams, rather than heading out to the movies with friends or countless other immediate temptations that awaited them in life. Age matters. Most children younger than 4 are unable to sustain delay of gratification on the marshmallow test. When faced with the temptations, they ring the bell or start nibbling on the treats within about 30 seconds. Their cool system is not yet sufficiently developed. In contrast, by age 12, almost 60% of children in some studies have been able to wait even as long as 25 minutes, a very long time to be sitting facing a few cookies and a bell in a barren little room. Gender also matters. Boys and girls develop different preferences at different phases of their development, and their willingness to wait will be influenced by the available rewards. What's rewarding to boys may be undesired by girls and vice versa, fire engines, dolls, swords, makeup kits. But even if the reward values are equated and the motivation is the same, girls usually wait longer than boys, and their cooling strategies may differ. I have not measured it, but preschool boys seem to use more physical strategies, like tilting and rocking back and forth on the chair or pushing the temptations away, while girls seem to sing to themselves more or try to simply tune out. But that's my impression only, not a finding. The greater willingness and ability of girls to wait longer is consistent with the finding that throughout the school years, at least in the United States, girls are usually rated higher on self-discipline measures than boys by their teachers, their parents, and themselves. Even in the first 4 years of life, girls are generally more compliant than boys. In later childhood, girls, on average, are usually seen as more self-disciplined in their schoolwork, and they often get better grades than boys. However, the raters, including the children themselves, share cultural stereotypes about gender differences. Good girls are expected to be conscientious and careful, and real boys are supposed to be more impulsive, harder to control, and even rowdy, rehearsing their football tackles more than their times tables. On hypothetical choices about delayed rewards, like would you prefer $55 today or $75 in 61 days, girls choose delayed rewards more often than boys. But when the choice becomes real rather than hypothetical, keep an envelope containing a $1 bill today or return it exactly 1 week later and get $2, the sex difference evaporates. In short, we keep looking for sex differences on the marshmallow test and other measures of self-control. We don't always find them, but on the whole, girls seem to have an advantage in the cognitive self-control skills and motivations that enable delay of gratification, at least in the populations and age groups studied so far. When dealing with temptations, one way to momentarily escape the hot system is to imagine how someone else would behave. It's easier to use the cool system when making hot choices for others rather than for oneself. A researcher whose name I can't remember but whose story I can't forget asked preschoolers to consider a choice between a small piece of chocolate right now and a very large piece in 10 minutes. He showed both pieces of chocolate to the children. When he asked the young boy, "What would an intelligent child choose?" the child responded that he would wait. When the researcher asked, "What will you do?" the child said, "I'll take it now." The same point was made in an experiment with 3-year-olds. They were given the choice between an immediate small reward and a delayed larger reward. When asked which one the experimenter would choose, they were able to use their cool system and were more likely to choose the delayed reward. But when they were choosing for themselves, the choice became hot, and most of them took the smaller reward right away. The effects of stress. Losing the cool system when you need it most. the experience of short-term stress can be adaptive, mobilizing you into action. Stress can become harmful, however, even toxic, if it is intense and persists. For example, in people who become enraged at every frustration, from traffic jams to checkout lines, or who feel overwhelmed under extreme and enduring conditions of danger, turbulence, or poverty. Prolonged stress impairs the PFC, which is essential not only for waiting for marshmallows, but also for things like surviving high school, holding down a job, pursuing an advanced degree, navigating office politics, avoiding depression, preserving relationships, and refraining from decisions that seem intuitively right, but on closer examination are really stupid. After reviewing research on the effects of stress, neuroscientist Amy Arnston of Yale University concluded that even quite mild acute uncontrollable stress can cause a rapid and dramatic loss of prefrontal cognitive abilities. The longer stress persists, the more those cognitive abilities are hurt and the more permanent the damage, ultimately leading to mental as well as physical illness. Thus, the part of the brain that enables creative problem-solving becomes less available the more we need it. Remember Hamlet. As his stress escalated, he became increasingly trapped and tortured, paralyzed in his angry ruminations and fragmented feelings, and unable to think or act effectively, thus wreaking havoc all around him and further accelerating his undoing. More than 400 years after Shakespeare so eloquently dramatized Hamlet's mental anguish, we can reconstruct what must have been going on in his brain. Not with the bard's magical language, but with a model of the brain under chronic stress. The architecture of the brain is literally remodeled under chronic stress. Hamlet didn't stand a chance. When his stress persisted, his cool system, specifically the prefrontal cortex, crucial for problem solving, and the hippocampus, important for memory, began to atrophy. Concurrently, his amygdala, at the core of the hot system, increased excessively in size. This combination of brain changes made self-control and cool thinking impossible. Further, as his stress continued long-term, his amygdala went from hypertrophy to atrophy, ultimately preventing normal emotional reactions. No wonder Hamlet was a tragedy. 4. The roots of self-control. How early in life can you see the ability to delay gratification or its lack in your children? I discussed this often with friends when, like me, they were in the early child-raising years. Everybody was convinced that they saw the roots of such differences almost from birth. They were sure that Valerie had it and Jimmy didn't. Sam, yes, absolutely. Celia, not at all. It guaranteed vivid anecdotes and a lively conversation that left the question dangling for future attention. In 1983, about 15 years after starting the marshmallow studies at Stanford, I accepted a professorship at Columbia University and moved back to New York City. One of the many enticements was that a young colleague, Lawrence Aber, was a faculty member at Barnard College, located across the street from Columbia. Larry was the research director of the Barnard Toddler Center, and we soon started a collaboration that continued for 2 decades. It was a chance to further study the dangling question about when and how delay ability develops. The strange situation. Waiting for marshmallows in the Bing surprise room may have been torture for 4- and 5-year-olds, but it was even tougher for an 18-month-old to have to wait for Mom to return after she had walked out of the little room in the Barnard Toddler Center and left her child alone with a stranger, a Barnard College volunteer, and some toys on the floor. Brief separations early in life are stresses that every child has to endure when the primary caretaker, usually the mother, begins to disappear, hopefully soon to return. By the middle of the 2nd year of life, toddlers already differ greatly in how anxiously or securely or ambivalently attached they are to their primary caretakers. What they do during such separations and reunions allows a peek into the quality of their relationships and their coping skills early in life. Mary Ainsworth designed the strange situation as a way to observe this relationship. Ainsworth was a student of John Bowlby, the highly influential British psychologist who, beginning in the 1930s, studied the effects of children's early life attachment experiences, especially the impact of separation from their primary caregivers, an all-too-common stressful experience in wartime. The strange situation simulates a brief maternal disappearance and reunion under controlled, benign conditions. Mom can come to the rescue quickly if her child's distress, expressed by heartbreaking crying or desperate pounding on the door, becomes excessive. The experiment plays out in three carefully scripted stages. First, during free play, mother and child, Benjamin in this example, are left alone in the room together for 5 minutes to play as you would at home. Second, in the separation episode, the school's director calls the mother out of the room, leaving Benjamin alone for 2 minutes with an undergraduate volunteer. Benjamin has previously seen or interacted with the volunteer in the presence of his mother for about 17 minutes. The volunteer remains silent during the separation unless Benjamin shows signs of distress, in which case she briefly reassures him that mommy's coming back. Third, during reunion, right after the 2 minute separation, the mother re-enters and picks Benjamin up. The volunteer leaves unobtrusively and mother and child play together for 3 minutes. In 1998, my student Anita Sethi wondered whether the 18-month-old's actions during separation predicted what he did 3 years later while waiting for his two marshmallows. To test this idea, we began at the Barnard Toddler Center, where we set up the strange situation and video recorded everything that happened during each stage. We noted the child's behavior during every 10-second frame, for example, whether he played or explored at a distance from his mother, distracted himself during her absence by looking at or playing with a toy, or engaged with the stranger. We also recorded his emotional expressions and any negative affect, crying, looking sad. The mother's spontaneous behavior was also coded in equal detail, including her attempts to initiate interaction with her child, her intrusions into his play or attempts to direct it, and her disregard of his cues. Maternal control, really over-control and insensitivity to the child's needs, was rated based on such cues as the mother's facial expression, vocal expression, position in relation to the child, amount of physical contact, expression of affection, and turn-taking, sharing. Toddlers who manage to distract themselves from mom's absence by playing with the toys, exploring the room, or engaging with the stranger avoided the intense distress experienced by those who could not tear themselves away from the door and quickly dissolved into tears. The toddler's stress during the mother's 2 minute absence escalated with every second of delay. That last stretch of 30 seconds must have felt endless, and toddlers' behavior during those toughest seconds proved to be especially diagnostic. It predicted, far from perfectly but much beyond chance, what they would do when taking the marshmallow test in preschool. Specifically, the toddlers who spent those last 30 seconds of separation in the strange situation, distracting themselves from mom's absence, became the ones who at age 5 waited longer for their treats and distracted themselves more effectively during the marshmallow test. In contrast, the toddlers who had been unable to activate the necessary distraction strategies were also unable to do so when waiting for their treats 3 years later and rang the bell sooner. These results underscore the importance of regulating attention to control and cool down stress beginning early in life. The vulnerable roots. At birth, infants are controlled almost completely by their internal state at each moment and by caregivers on whom they depend. In the infant's first few months outside the womb, soothing, rocking, feeding, and cuddling become a major job for caregivers night and day. How lovingly and caringly infants are nurtured or how cruelly and coldly they are neglected or abused is inscribed in their brains and changes who they become. It is critical to keep infant stress levels from becoming chronically activated and to promote the formation of close, warm attachments so the babies feel secure and safe. The plasticity of the brain, especially in the first year of life, makes infants highly vulnerable to damage in their key neural systems if they have extremely adverse experiences, such as severe maltreatment or uncaring institutional rearing. Surprisingly, even much more moderate environmental stressors, such as exposure to persistent, albeit non-physical, conflict between parents, may take a serious toll. In one study, while infants aged 6 to 12 months were sleeping, their brains were scanned by fMRI. When they heard very angry-sounding speech while sleeping, the babies living with parents who had persistent conflicts, compared with those in less conflict-filled homes, had higher activation in the brain areas that regulate emotion and stress. Findings like these suggest that even relatively moderate stressors from the social environment during critical periods of development are registered in the HOT system. It is clear that as babies develop, their early emotional experiences are embedded into the architecture of their brains, and this can have huge consequences on how their lives unfold. Fortunately, interventions designed to enhance how babies regulate their emotions and develop cognitive, social, and emotional skills have the best chance to make a difference during those early years of life when children are most vulnerable to damage. Within a few months of birth, caregivers can begin to switch their infant's attention away from feelings of distress and toward activities that interest them. And in time, this helps their babies learn to self-distract and to calm themselves. At the neural level, babies begin to develop the midfrontal area of the brain as an attention control system for cooling and regulating their negative emotions. If all goes well, they become less reflexive, more reflective, less hot, more cool, and able to express their own goals, feelings, and intentions appropriately. Discussing this process, Michael Posner and Mary Rothbart, two pioneers in the field of self-regulation development, say, "Children who at 4 months of age look at all the stimuli presented return to the lab a year and a half later with their own agenda. It is hard to get them to attend to our displays because their own plans take precedence. After making heroic efforts, we can only shake our heads and mumble that they have a mind of their own," emphasis mind. As parents know, the second birthday is likely to come at around the time of the child's unwritten declaration of independence. In its early revolutionary phases, this striving for independence makes life challenging, to put it gently, for caregivers. Around the age of 2 to 3 years, children begin to be able to exert control over their thoughts, feelings, and actions, and this skill becomes increasingly visible during the 4th and 5th years of life. It is critical for success in the marshmallow test, as well as for adapting to school and beyond. By age 3, children can usually begin to make some purposeful choices, regulate their attention more flexibly, and inhibit impulses that would distract them from their goal. For example, studies by Stephanie Carlson and her colleagues at the University of Minnesota show that children can manage to follow 2 simple rules, like if it's blue, put it here, but if it's red, put it there, long enough to reach their goal, often verbalizing self-instructions to help them figure out what they have to do. While impressive, these skills remain limited in the 3rd year, but children make great strides in the following 2 years. By the time they reach their 5th birthday, their minds have become wonderfully sophisticated. There are large individual differences, of course, but many 5-year-olds can understand and follow complex rules, like if it's the color game, put the red square here, but if it's the shape game, put the red square there. While these skills are still in the early stages in the preschooler, by age 7, children's attention control skills and the underlying neural circuits are surprisingly similar to those of adults. The child's experiences in the first half dozen years of life become roots for the ability to regulate impulses, exercise self-restraint, control the expression of emotions, and develop empathy, mindfulness, and conscience. What if you have a mother like Portnoy had? How does a mother's parenting style influence the self-control strategies and attachment that her child develops? In Anita Sethi's toddler study described earlier, we measured the mother's behavior in detail to assess her level and style of maternal control and her sensitivity to her child's needs. Consider, for example, the mother who is over-controlling and micromanaging and who focuses mostly on her own needs rather than the child's. This profile is captured famously in Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint. As the protagonist looks back at his early childhood in New Jersey, he vividly recalls his mother's well-intended but stifling over-control, the intrusiveness with which she inspected, evaluated, and corrected everything from his arithmetic to the condition of his socks, nails, neck, and every crevice of his body. And when young Portnoy, overstuffed with his mother's loving cuisine, refuses to eat more pot roast, she persists, holding a long bread knife in her hand, and rhetorically asks, "Does he want to become a skinny weakling to be respected or ridiculed, a man or a mouse?" Portnoy's mother is a fictional creation, but I have friends who insist that their mothers were just like her. For a toddler who has Mrs. Portnoy for a mother, the path to achieving self-control skills may be very different from, indeed opposite, the one for the toddler with a less controlling mother. That is exactly what Anita found when she looked at the spontaneous interactions between the toddlers and their mothers when they were together in the room. Toddlers who developed effective self-control skills by preschool generally responded to their highly controlling mother's bids for attention, not by sticking close to her, but by distracting and distancing themselves from her, more than 3 feet, to explore the room and play with the toys. Toddlers who distanced themselves from their controlling mothers, who literally moved away when she made approach overtures, were able to delay longer on the marshmallow test at age 5. They succeeded by using attention control strategies to cool their frustration, distracting themselves from the rewards and the bell in the same way that as toddlers they had distracted themselves from their controlling mothers. In contrast, the toddlers who had equally controlling mothers but who hung close when mom made her bids for attention focused on the temptations when they took the marshmallow test and quickly rang the bell. For toddlers whose mothers were less controlling, it was a different story. When those mothers tried to engage their toddlers, the ones who stayed close were the ones who showed more effective self-control and cooling strategies during the marshmallow test at age 5. They distracted themselves strategically, focused less on the temptations, and waited longer to get their bigger rewards than children who, as toddlers, had distanced themselves from such mothers. What are the implications? A toddler with a mother who is not excessively controlling and is sensitive to his needs has no reason to distance himself from her, and he stays close when she approaches in the strange situation to reduce his stress. But what if a child has a mother who is highly sensitive to what she wants, but blind to what her child needs when he most needs it, and who tries to control his every move in ways that distress him? Anita's results raise some questions to consider. It may not be a bad idea for the toddler to move a few feet away from his mom to play with the toys and explore the room. It may even help him develop the self-control cooling skills that he'll need to get those 2 marshmallows when he is age 5. To examine these possibilities, Annie Bernier of the University of Montreal led a research team in 2010 that studied how mothers interacted with their children aged 12 to 15 months to see how those interactions influenced the development of self-control. The researchers carefully examined how the mothers engaged with their toddlers when they worked together on puzzles and other cognitive tasks. Then they tested the same children again at age 16 to 26 months. Bernier found that the children of mothers who had in the earlier study encouraged their toddlers' autonomy by supporting their choices and sense of volition subsequently had the strongest cognitive and attention control skills of the kind needed for success on the marshmallow test. This was true even when the researchers controlled for differences in the mother's cognitive ability and education. The message here is that parents who over-control their toddlers risk undermining the development of their children's self-control skills, while those who support and encourage autonomy and problem-solving efforts are likely to maximize their children's chances of coming home from preschool, eager to tell them how they got their 2 marshmallows. 5. The best-laid plans. Homer's ancient Greek legend, the Odyssey, tells of the adventures of Odysseus, Ulysses in the Roman version, the king of a small rugged island called Ithaca on Greece's western coast. The king leaves his new wife, Penelope, and their infant son at home and sets sail to fight in the Trojan War. Unexpectedly, the war drags on for many years, and so does Odysseus's journey home, which is filled with fantastic adventures of wild new loves, terrible battles, and tangles with horrific monsters. As he tries at long last to return home with his remaining sailors, they approach the land of the wondrous sirens, whose irresistibly seductive voices and songs so enchant sailors on passing ships that they crash into the rocks and drown. Odysseus was desperately eager to hear the siren songs, but he was also aware of the hazards. In one of the Western world's earliest chronicles of advanced planning done to resist temptation, he ordered his sailors to tie him firmly to the vessel's mainmast and leave him bound there. "And if I beseech and bid you to set me free, then do ye straiten me with yet more bonds." To protect themselves and assure that he remained tied, the sailors were ordered to plug up their ears with beeswax. Mr. Clownbox. In the early 1970s, when the marshmallow experiments were well underway, I vaguely remembered Homer's tales. I also wondered whether Adam and Eve might have held on to paradise longer if they had had plans at the ready to help them resist snakes and apple temptations. I started to think about the Bing preschoolers. How would they deal with a powerful tempter who seduced their attention while they struggled to avoid the heavy costs of succumbing to him? Would advanced planning help them resist? At that time, Charlotte Patterson, now a professor at the University of Virginia, was my graduate student at Stanford, and together we began to ask that question. As a first step, we needed a siren-like tempter appropriate for preschoolers in the surprise room. He, she, or it had to meet two criteria. The tempter had to be seductive, but also considered acceptable to parents, the Bing nursery school director, and the researchers, in addition to my three young daughters who served as my advisory board. The result was Mr. Clownbox. Mr. Clownbox was a large wooden box with a brightly painted clown's face. The smiling face was surrounded by blinking lights and flanked by outstretched arms, each appearing to hold up a glass-windowed compartment. When the compartment lights turned on, tempting little toys and treats rotated very slowly on a drum inside each window. Mr. Clownbox was a big talker and a powerful tempter. A speaker hidden in his head was connected to a tape recorder and microphone in the observation room. We wanted to simulate a situation that everyone faces repeatedly in life, when you have to resist powerful immediate temptations and seductions for the sake of more important but delayed outcomes. Think of the teenager trying to complete overdue homework who was asked to join his best friends for a movie, or the happily married older executive invited for drinks by the attractive young personal assistant after a long day together at the annual sales convention far from home. Mr. Clownbox served as the seducer who would greatly tempt young kids. During these studies, Charlotte played briefly with the child, in this example Saul, age 4, in a corner of the surprise room that contained both attractive and broken toys. She then seated Saul at a small table facing Mr. Clownbox. She explained that she would have to leave the room for a while, and she showed Saul his job. He had to work the whole time, without interruption, on a particularly boring task. For example, he might have to copy the squares from a worksheet filled with either X's or O's into the adjacent empty squares on the same worksheet, or put little pegs from a large pile into a pegboard. If he did that without interruption, then he could play with the fun toys and Mr. Clownbox when Charlotte returned. Otherwise, he would be able to play with only the broken toys. She emphasized that he had to work the whole time she was out of the room in order to finish his job, and he solemnly promised he would do so. She carefully forewarned Saul that Mr. Clownbox might try hard to play with him, and she stressed that looking at, talking to, or playing with him would make it impossible for Saul to finish his job. Charlotte then invited Sol to meet Mr. Clownbox, who lit up brightly, flashing his lights and illuminating his toy-filled windows, and introduced himself in a loud and pleasant voice. "Hi, I'm Mr. Clownbox. I have big ears, and I love it when children fill them with all the things they think and feel, no matter what." He had obviously had at least some training in psychotherapy. Mr. Clownbox ahemmed and ahaed encouragingly in response to whatever Sol said, and engaged him in a brief, pleasant conversation in which he invited Sol to play with him. He demonstrated that a distinctive bzzz sound indicated that he was about to do something fun that Sol would want to watch, and briefly lit his display windows, letting Sol glimpse the attractive toys and treats rotating slowly within them. A minute after Charlotte exited, Mr. Clownbox lit up, flashed his lights, and laughed. "Ho, ho, ho, ho! I love to have children play with me. Will you play with me? Just come over and push my nose and see what happens. Oh, please, won't you push my nose?" For the next 10 minutes, he continued his tortures, mercilessly tempting the child, his lights turning on and off around his face and in his display windows, a bright light on his bow tie also flashing. He resumed his seductive efforts every 1.5 minutes. "Oh, I'm having such a good time. I'll make even more fun for us if you just put down your pencil. Put down your pencil and then we'll really have a good time. Please put down your pencil and come play with me. Just come over and push my nose and then I'll do tricks for you. Wouldn't you like to see some of my surprises? Look in my windows now." 11 minutes after Charlotte's exit, Mr. Clownbox turned off, and she returned to the surprise room. If then plans for resisting temptation. For preschoolers, the clown was probably as tough to resist as the sirens were for Odysseus, and unlike the Greek hero tied to his mast, the kids were not bound to their chairs, nor did they have beeswax in their ears like his crew. Our question was, what could help preschoolers like Sol better resist the temptations that Mr. Clownbox would use to lure them? Guided by the marshmallow findings, we figured that to effectively resist a hot temptation, whether to eat the marshmallow now or cave in to any other temptation, the inhibitory no response had to replace the hot go response. And it had to do this quickly and automatically, like a reflex. All you needed in the language of Hollywood's movie industry was a good connection, one that created an automatic link between the needed no response and the hot stimulus, which normally triggered go. For example, one temptation-inhibiting plan might be to instruct the preschooler as follows. "Let's try to think of some things that you could do to keep yourself working and not let Mr. Clownbox slow you down. Let's see, one thing you can do is this. When Mr. Clownbox makes that bzzzt sound and asks you to look at him and play with him, you can just look at your work, not him, and say, 'No, I can't, I'm working.' And when you say it, do it. He says, 'Look,' and you say, 'No, I can't, I'm working.'" This type of if-then plan specifies the tempting hot stimulus, when Mr. Clownbox says to look at him and play with him, and links it to the desired temptation-resisting response, then you can just not look at him and say, "I'm not going to look at Mr. Clownbox." Preschoolers armed with this type of plan reduced their distraction time and kept on working with the best results. Even when the clown succeeded in distracting them from their work, the disruption lasted on average less than 5 seconds, and the children inserted an average of 138 pegs into their pegboards. In contrast, those without this type of plan interrupted their work for an average of 24 seconds per distraction and inserted only 97 pegs. In the preschool world of peg insertion, these were big differences. We also saw that many children who received this plan instruction innovated their own variations. "Quit that, stop that, dummy," which let them get their pegs into the holes faster and ultimately allowed them to play happily with Mr. Clownbox as well as with the unbroken toys. Our research with Mr. Clownbox turned out to be the opening step for an important independent research program developed many years later by Peter Goldwitzer and Gabrielle Ettingen and their colleagues at New York University. Beginning in the 1990s, they identified simple but surprisingly powerful if-then plans for helping people deal more effectively with a wide variety of otherwise crippling self-control problems, even under very difficult and emotionally hot conditions when they were trying to pursue important but hard-to-achieve goals. Now called if-then implementation plans, these plans have helped students study in the midst of intrusive temptations and distractions, aided dieters in foregoing their favorite snacks, and enabled children with attention deficit disorders to inhibit inappropriate impulsive responses. Taking the effort out of effortful control. With practice, the desired action of an implementation plan becomes initiated automatically when the relevant situational cues occur. When the clock hits 5 p.m., I will read my textbook. I will start writing the paper the day after Christmas. When the dessert menu is served, I will not order the chocolate cake. Whenever the distraction arises, I will ignore it. And implementation plans work not just when the if is in the external environment, when the alarm rings, when I enter the bar, but also when the cue is your internal state, when I'm craving something, when I'm bored, when I'm anxious, when I'm angry. It sounds simple, and it is. By forming and practicing implementation plans, you can make your HOT system reflexively trigger the desired response whenever the cue occurs. Over time, a new association or habit is formed, like brushing teeth before going to bed. Such if-then plans, when they become automatic, take the effort out of effortful control. You can trick the HOT system into reflexively and unconsciously doing the work for you. The HOT system then lets you automatically act out the script you want when you need it, while your cool system rests. But unless you incorporate the resistance plan into the HOT system, it is unlikely to be activated when you need it most. That is because emotional arousal and stress increase when you are faced with hot temptations, thus accelerating the HOT system, triggering the quick automatic go response, and attenuating the cool system. When the hot temptation arrives, whether from Mr. Clownbox flashing his lights in the surprise room, the chocolate dessert on the menu, or the attractive colleague in the bar at the business convention, the automatic go response is likely to win if there is no well-established if-then plan. However, when if-then plans are established, they work well in surprisingly diverse settings with different populations and age groups, and they can help people more effectively achieve difficult goals. Goals that they previously thought they could not reach. One impressive example is with children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. ADHD is an increasingly common problem, and children who have it often experience many academic and interpersonal troubles. They are highly vulnerable to distraction and tend to have difficulty controlling their attention, making it hard to stay task-oriented. These cognitive limitations can undermine children with ADHD in many academic and social situations, causing stigmatization and the risk of over-medication. If-then implementation plans have helped such children solve math problems faster, substantially improve on tasks assessing working memory, and persevere in their efforts to resist distraction under very difficult laboratory conditions. These applications illustrate the power and value of implementation plans and paint an optimistic picture of the human potential for self-generated change. The continuing challenge is to translate these procedures from short-term experiments into long-term intervention programs that produce sustained change in everyday life. 6. Idle grasshoppers and busy ants. The marshmallow experiments allowed us to see how children manage to delay and resist temptation and how differences in this ability play out over a lifetime. But what about the choice itself? I started to ask that question while I was a graduate student at Ohio State University, well before I joined the Stanford faculty. I spent one summer living near a small village in the southern tip of Trinidad. The inhabitants in this part of the island were either of African or East Indian descent, their ancestors having arrived as either slaves or indentured servants. Each group lived peacefully in its own enclave on different sides of the same long dirt road that divided their homes. As I got to know my neighbors, I became fascinated by what they told me about their lives. I discovered a recurrent theme in how they characterized each other. According to the East Indians, the Africans were just pleasure-bent, impulsive, and eager to have a good time and live in the moment, while never planning or thinking ahead about the future. The Africans saw their East Indian neighbors as always working and slaving for the future, stuffing their money under the mattress without ever enjoying life. Their descriptions were strikingly reminiscent of Aesop's classic fable about the grasshopper and the ant. The indolent, hedonistic grasshopper is hopping around, chirping happily in the summer sun and enjoying the here and now, while the worried, busy ant is toiling to put away food for the winter. The grasshopper is indulging in hot system pleasures, while the ant is delaying gratification for the sake of later survival. Did the road that separated the two groups in this village really divide self-indulgent grasshopper types from future-oriented, hard-working ants? To check if the perceptions about the differences between the ethnic groups were accurate, I walked down the long dirt road to the local school, which was attended by children from both groups. The school was still run by the British colonial educational system, and the children were dressed in fresh white shirts or blouses. Everything seemed neat, proper, and orderly, and the children waited with clasped hands for the teacher to begin the lesson. The teachers welcomed me into their classrooms, where I tested boys and girls between the ages of 11 and 14. I asked the children who lived in their home, gauged their trust that promises made would be promises kept, and assessed their achievement motivation, social responsibility, and intelligence. At the end of each of these sessions, I gave them choices between little treats, either one tiny chocolate that they could have immediately, or a much bigger one that they could get the following week. During the session, they also chose between receiving $10 right then or $30 if they waited a month, and between a much larger gift much later or a smaller one now. The young adolescents in Trinidad who most frequently chose the immediate smaller rewards in contrast to those who chose the delayed larger ones were more often in trouble and, in the language of the time, judged to be juvenile delinquents. Consistently, they were seen as less socially responsible, and they had often already had serious issues with authorities and the police. They also scored much lower on the standard test of achievement motivation and showed less ambition in the goals they had for themselves for the future. Trust. Consistent with the stereotypes I heard from their parents, the African Trinidadian kids generally preferred the immediate rewards, and those from East Indian families chose the delayed ones much more often. But surely there was more to the story. Perhaps those who came from homes with absent fathers, a common occurrence at that time in the African families in Trinidad, while very rare for the East Indians, had fewer experiences with men who kept their promises. If so, they would have less trust that the stranger, me, would ever really show up later with the promised delayed reward. There's no good reason for anyone to forgo the now unless there's trust that the later will materialize. In fact, when I compared the two ethnic groups by looking only at children who had a man living in the household, the differences between the groups disappeared. Beginning in early childhood, far too many people live in untrustworthy, unreliable worlds in which promises for delayed, larger rewards are made but never kept. Given this history, it makes little sense to wait rather than grab whatever is at hand. When preschoolers have an experience with a promise maker who fails to keep his promise, not surprisingly, they're much less likely to be willing to wait for two marshmallows than to take one now. These common sense expectations have long been confirmed in experiments demonstrating that when people don't expect delayed rewards to be delivered, they behave rationally and won't choose to wait for them. A few years after my time in Trinidad, before the marshmallow experiments, I was teaching at Harvard, and I continued to study such choices among children and adolescents in Cambridge and Boston. The year 1960 was an odd moment in history to be studying delay of gratification and self-control in Harvard University's Social Relations Department. Much was changing. Timothy Leary had joined the faculty and was experimenting with the magic mushrooms he had found on a trip to Mexico, attempting to create new psychedelic mind-altering experiences, not just in himself, but also in our students. One morning, mattresses suddenly replaced several of the graduate student desks, and large packages from a chemical company in Switzerland began to arrive in the department mail. With the help of the drug LSD, the age of turn-on, tune-in, drop-out had begun. Leary was leading the charge into the counterculture, and many of our graduate students followed him. As much of the world seemed to be losing self-control, it felt particularly timely to keep studying it. Carol Gilligan, who was working toward a doctoral degree, and I collaborated on a new project testing sixth-grade boys from two public schools in the Boston area. We wanted to see if children who considered